Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. A reminder that today is tax day. Your federal and state tax returns are due to be filed no later than midnight tonight. The IRS is one of several agencies that is in the crosshairs of DOGE, the entity headed by Trump donor Elon Musk, who has promised to reduce the size of the federal workforce and save the government $2 trillion. My first guest today is Representative Sarah Elfrith, who has just passed the 100-day mark in her first term representing Maryland's 3rd Congressional District. Last month, Congresswoman Elfrith introduced legislation called the Protect Our Probationary Employees Act. She's also held town halls and listed resources to assist federal workers who are facing layoffs. Representative Elfrith joins us on Zoom from Washington. Congresswoman, welcome. Congresswoman, can you hear me?
I can hear you now, Tom.
There we go. Takes us a second. We appreciate your time. And tell us about this bill, the Probationary Employee Protection or Protect Our Probationary Employees Act. What do you hope to achieve with that?
Yeah, it's an important issue. And listen, there are many issues across the board right now, the actions of this White House, particularly as it affects our civil servants. But we tried to hone in on, you know, something small, something I could get bipartisan support on. So this bill simply says that if you're a probationary employee and you were fired and you are reinstated because the courts said you needed to be, which is happening, or because Elon Musk has admitted to making a mistake, which he has, that we should respect the time that you've given already. We had a Marylander who was one day away from ending his probationary status before he was fired. And so this bill simply says, if you are reinstated, you come back to work, we should respect the time and you won't have to restart that clock. It's such a simple idea. I've been able to get 4 Republican co-sponsors on this bill. It's the first and only bipartisan DOGE bill in Congress. And that's important because I'm serious about this, getting this bill moving, Tom. I've already reached out to the chair of the Oversight Committee where this would be heard. I asked him for a hearing. I spend every day across the aisle trying to get this bill moving because it if passed, it will be able to positively impact a lot of people's lives.
And it will give these employees confidence or the assurance that when they are reinstated, they won't have to start their probationary periods over again, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's, very important. Are the courts ultimately going to be the place where remedies for the overreach of the Trump administration take place?
That's my view. Certainly in a Congress where Republicans have majorities in the House and the Senate, we're not seeing what I view as the necessary check and balance that Congress normally provides to the White House. Instead, we're seeing the judiciary play that role. And that's exactly why the framers positioned us as such. And so we're seeing these court actions take effect across this country from judges who were appointed by Republicans and Democrats alike. As a member of Congress, I am filing legislation, but again, I can't get that legislation to move without Republican support. So what I can also do, though, is file amicus briefs in the courts on behalf of my constituents on relevant cases. And that's what I'm doing as well. But the courts are really that backstop right now and a lot of our focus.
In the 3rd District, what's your take on how many of your constituents are federal employees? I heard a number of 80,000, which I think was a combination of your district and Congresswoman McLean Delaney's district. But in the 3rd, what are you talking about?
We're talking about 44,000 direct federal employees, but really important, Tom, about 2 or 3 times that in terms of contractors or folks who rely on some form of federal grant. And so outsized impact on my district, obviously. But it's also important to note that while we feel it so acutely here in Maryland and Virginia, 85% of federal workers actually work outside of the DMV region. We're just feeling it so acutely right now. It's why I'm so involved in the community. We have a town hall tonight. I'm going to hear more from my constituents. I can't go to the grocery store right now without, you know, speaking to a constituent who themselves was impacted or somebody in their family has been impacted. So it's very acute here in the third district, but it's a problem across this country.
And what is your recommendation to those federal employees, the contractors perhaps in a different category? They may have really very limited recourse in this situation. But for the folks who are on the payroll of the federal government and they get a termination notice, what are you telling them to do?
Well, first of all, contact their union, and most federal employees are going to be represented by a union. Second of all, they can, you know, there's administrative measures where they can appeal that decision. So try their best to exhaust those measures, and they can always reach out to my office as well, and we can do our best. You know, Senator Bob Mikulski is a mentor of mine. We sit down to lunch quarterly. She has a great line of, we can't guarantee an outcome, but we can guarantee an effort. That's what my office is here to do. And we've had some success stories so far. So folks are always welcome to reach out to my office, and we're going to do our damnedest to help.
The Trump administration has dismissed some 24,000 federal employees so far, as I understand it, earlier this month, about a week ago. The Fourth Circuit Court, rather, of Appeals vacated a lower court ruling that ordered about 20 different federal agencies to reinstate tens of thousands of employees who had been terminated. That was, you know, seen as a win for the Trump administration. I mean, with these amicus briefs, with the other lawsuits that are pending in various levels of the judicial system, what's your take on how the courts are generally speaking responding to the way that the Trump administration is going about this?
Well, the ruling that you referred to, Tom, I think it's important to note that the case was not taken up because of a standing issue, not because of the merits of the case. The courts ruled that the unions in this case didn't have the standing to sue on behalf of their members. So it was not about the merits here. It was about a standing issue. I disagree with that. I think that's exactly why unions are here, to advocate on behalf of their members and the community and the courts. But it's not, the important thing is it wasn't thrown out for merit. Also really important, Tom, is we can have conversations all day about government efficiency. And I come from, as you know, the Maryland State Senate, where we had to balance a budget every year and have really difficult conversations about government efficiency every year. I am here for that conversation, but that's not what's happening. We're seeing these, you know, unilateral firings across the board without thought of keeping government services intact, without thinking about how are we not losing the best and the brightest and the most experienced in civil service, without thinking about, you know, what is the impact to the average American here. You know, the president talks all the time about not wanting to cut Social Security benefits, for instance, but if we cut Social Security staff by 7,000, which is what they are attempting to do right now, if folks aren't there to answer the phone or to file the paperwork or to cut the checks, that's a de facto benefit cut to Americans, even if we're not cutting benefits. And so we have to think about how is government best delivering services, and our civil service should reflect that ethos. But that's not what's happening in this administration. They're taking a machete to the civil service without thought or strategy.
And have you been hearing from constituents about problems at Social Security? It's early in the process of the cuts that they are pursuing. Have you heard from constituents about the IRS or any other agency whom they may contact who are not in a position to be helpful?
Yes, we're hearing it across. We're hearing it at VA as well. Veterans who are unable to get an appointment for health benefits. We're hearing it certainly from the IRS during peak tax season. We're hearing it from immigration services, people who have been in line for green cards or citizenship. That has been a backlog for a long time. So we're hearing it across the board. And again, we should have the right size government in order to meet the services that taxpayers pay for. And that's what I am focused on right now.
Congresswoman Sarah Elfrith is my guest. She represents the 3rd District here in Maryland. If you have a question or comment for the Congresswoman, 410-662-8780, or email midday@wipr.org. So, Representative, I want to ask you about Kilmar Abrego Garcia. He is not a constituent of yours. He doesn't live in your district. He lives in Glen Ivy's district in the 4th District. But there was a meeting in the Oval Office yesterday with the president of El Salvador, President Bukele, who reinstated or reasserted the fact that he's not going to release Mr. Abrego Garcia from the prison he's currently detained in El Salvador. Senator Chris Van Hollen has talked about going down there himself, seeing if he can secure Mr. Abrego Garcia's release. What do you understand is going on with that, given the Supreme Court's ruling that the administration is obliged to facilitate his process and his release? Where does that stand?
Well, first of all, I think we need to talk about this as it's a miscarriage of justice, Tom. Due process is a fundamental American right and value. It's part of why we were founded as a nation, and we're seeing due process thrown out the window here. The facts are clear. Mr. Garcia was here under he had a protective status from a judge from 2019. He was picked up and sent to El Salvador without any due process. As you mentioned, a number of courts, including a 9-0 ruling by the Supreme Court, said that the government needs to return him to the United States to his family here in Maryland. And the show that we witnessed, and I'm being diplomatic when I say that, in the Oval Office yesterday was astonishing. Because, you know, we talk about slippery slopes a lot here in politics, but I cannot imagine, Tom, where we could possibly go if due process in this case is not respected. We could be, as a government, pulling people off the streets, not giving them any opportunity to prove their immigration status, and sending them to maximum security prisons with no track record of civil rights law, and human rights violations are rampant here. It's a terrifying proposition that this case poses if we do not respect the very basic right of anybody here in America to have due process. So I applaud Senator Van Hollen for possibly going down to El Salvador. I'm grateful to be a part of a delegation that is so tight knit, I'm grateful that he's taking that stand.
I'd like to get your reaction to, for example, the comments by Stephen Miller, who's a senior advisor to President Trump, yesterday in the Oval Office, who said that the decision by the Supreme Court, which is a 9-0 decision, calling for the facilitation of Mr. Abrego Garcia's return to the United States, was actually a victory for the Trump administration, a victory for the people who see it as he sees it, saying that the court reaffirmed that courts should not interfere with the president's capacity and authority to conduct foreign policy. How do you respond to Mr. Miller's contention?
Well, he's a master of the spin, but he does not know what he is talking about. The administration has not at all proven their case that Mr. Garcia was involved in a gang or in some way a terrorist, because they're not respecting his due process rights. So Mr. Miller can spin this all day long, but Mr. Garcia deserves due process. He deserves to be with his family right now. And the White House is getting dangerously close to subverting the rule of the Supreme Court.
There's another hearing by the judge here in Maryland this afternoon at 4:00. It'll be interesting to see if any of the statements made yesterday that were not made under oath, they were made at, you know, essentially a press conference at the White House, are introduced and considered by the court. I want to switch topics now to the reconciliation bill that was passed by the Senate the other night, last Friday. The House had already passed a version of its own. It was a much tighter vote in the House than it was in the Senate, but it sets a blueprint. It sets a framework for the next step of the reconciliation process to come up with a tax bill, a budget bill. Your reaction to what that framework looks like, what concerns you, and where will the Democrats be when it gets down to committees who've been charged with making some pretty severe cuts to some pretty longstanding programs?
Yes, Tom, can I take a minute? Because I didn't understand this process before I got to Congress. So I think it's important to set the table here. What we're talking about is the long-term budget blueprint for the federal government, not necessarily not this year's budget. So the vote that we took last week simply tells the various committees that they have to find certain targets in reduction. The most concerning reduction to me is $880 billion. And cuts to what truly can only be taken out of Medicaid. And the president can say all day long he doesn't want to touch Medicaid, but that's the hard truth of what this budget resolution calls for. And let me just be clear with what Medicaid does, because I think it's important to tell the whole truth about it. Medicaid covers more children and more seniors than I think people understand. In the third district alone, it's about 134,000 people have their healthcare coverage through Medicaid. That's 60,000 kids. That's 9,000 seniors. Tom, something I didn't know before I got here was that 62% of seniors living in nursing homes rely on Medicaid for that health coverage because Medicare does not cover it. And so when we talk about such a drastic cut, this is frankly going to impact my colleagues in Republican districts a little more than mine, but regardless, we're talking about humans. We're talking about healthcare coverage. We're talking about a program that is wildly popular, and this budget resolution.
Oh, and I'm sorry that it seems that our connection with Representative Elfrith has abandoned us, and we are working feverishly to try to get it back. We do have the Congresswoman for a few more minutes here on Midday. If you've just joined us, my guest is Congresswoman Sarah Elfrith. Congresswoman Elfrith, I guess we have you back on the phone now. We're gonna do this old school, huh?
Sorry about that. I think one of our Wi-Fis is not working. Where did I lose you, Tom?
We're talking about the reconciliation bill and the cuts to Medicaid. Why is it that the Medicaid is such a big target with this blueprint that's been passed by both chambers now?
Sure. I think I was saying that the budget resolution is just that. It's a blueprint. And now the committees have to go to work to try to find how to meet the demands, the $2 trillion in demands that this budget resolution calls for. The biggest chunk of that is an $880 billion cut to the committee that is responsible for Medicaid. So if the president talks about not wanting to touch Social Security or Medicare, the only thing left is this Medicaid pot of money. And I think it's so important that we humanize Medicaid, because we're talking about children, we're talking about seniors, we're talking about new mothers. We're talking about the fact that in my district alone, 60,000 kids rely on Medicaid for their health insurance, 9,000 seniors, 61% of seniors living in nursing homes across this country rely on Medicaid for their health insurance because Medicare does not cover assisted living facilities. So this will be a pretty devastating cut to districts across this country, certainly mine, but frankly, there tend to be higher proportions of Medicaid recipients in Republican districts. And so it's particularly devastating to see this potential cut. And I also think it's important, Tom, that we level set here, because there's a notion that this budget resolution is all about fiscal responsibility because it calls for $2 trillion in cuts. It also calls for $4 trillion increase to our debt ceiling. It also calls for $14 trillion addition to our debt over the next decade because of the tax cuts that are being proposed here. So this is not about fiscal responsibility in my mind. This is about forcing the most vulnerable people in our communities, kids, seniors, folks of low income, to pay for tax cuts for corporations and the wealthiest among us. So it's not an honest conversation that my colleagues are having right now.
We have a caller from Middletown. Margaret is on the line with a quick question for Congresswoman Elfrith. What's your comment for the Congresswoman?
My comment is my husband died, and I tried to call OPM because he was a former employee. He was retired because I am due to get half of his retirement benefits. I called them. They were supposed to send me the form and assign me a claim number. Well, I never got the claim number. I never got the form. And now when I call them, I get what it says is, we're very busy now. Call back later. I've called them six times this morning, and I get the same thing every day, so I don't think anybody is at OPM at all.
Oh, yeah. Margaret, we're so sorry for the loss of your husband and the problems you're having. But Congresswoman Elfrith, this sounds like a pretty common complaint that you're hearing.
It is a common complaint. And again, I'm so sorry for the loss of your husband. And I'm sorry that, you know, bureaucratic red tape and these cuts to the civil service are impacting you like this. Listen, please, Margaret, please reach out to my office. I don't represent you, but we can get you in touch with your member of Congress and make sure that we advocate for you. So if you go to elfris.house.gov, my office can make sure that we work with you, and we are, and I like to joke here, but we are that sharp elbow when we need to be. And so I want to make sure we're helpful to you too.
And Congresswoman, we have to let you go, but before I do, I do want to give you a chance to comment on the effect of the tariffs that have been so much in the news. How are they? What are you hearing from your constituents about the tariffs and about the economic chaos that we've endured over the last couple of weeks?
Yeah, and this is another place I've heard from a lot of constituents, Tom, a lot of seniors who their retirement income is tied up in the markets and saw significant losses because of the president's, frankly, willy-nilly approach to tariffs. He claims to want to bring back manufacturing to the states, and I think we all do, but there's no plan to do that. And at the same time, the federal government just cut about $1 million grant to Maryland to boost manufacturing. So there's no strategy here. There's no thinking through, you know, I think there's an argument, I'm not an economist, but there's an argument to be made that strategic tariffs that are targeted to specific things can help rebalance trade. But that's, again, that's not what's happening here. We're seeing a willy-nilly approach to this that is causing significant harm to the stock market, to seniors on fixed incomes, to small businesses. I met with a small business owner, a veteran in my district today, who has a pet company. They make harnesses and leashes for dogs. All of that is manufactured abroad, and the raw materials for that are from abroad. So it's, you know, and he told me today, a leash that he sells for $30 that's produced abroad, if you were to reshore his company, he would be selling that leash for $120. He wouldn't sell a single leash, Tom. So this approach doesn't make any sense from how do we actually support the small businesses that are the backbone of our economy?
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. But, of course, we will stay very much in touch as all of these things play out and as your term continues. Representative Sarah Elfrith is Maryland's Congresswoman from the 3rd District. Many thanks. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom.
And up next, where the size of the population of Baltimore City is headed and how to keep it heading up. The city historian Charlie Duff has some ideas about all that. We'll talk about them on the other side of a quick break. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday on WYPR.